Coming up, it's Philosophy Talk.
What is this salty discharge?
Oh my God, you're crying.
This is horrible.
Feeling sad after the death of a loved one is now considered a mental disorder to be treated with drugs.
Doesn't that suggest psychiatry is just a sham?
What will this do?
Well, what it does is reaches into your brain chemically and locates your happiest memory chemically and then locks onto that emotion and freezes it chemically.
I want a new drug, one that does what it should.
Are psychiatric disorders just something that Big Pharma made up to sell us more drugs?
Diseases of the mind, the philosophy of psychiatry.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're here at the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Stanford at Philosopher's Corner, where Ken teaches philosophy, and I did for 40 years.
Today, we're thinking about disorders of the mind, the philosophy of psychiatry.
You know, Ken, there's something a little odd about how psychiatry defines mental disorders by their symptoms rather than their causes.
Well, how else would people go about diagnosing psychiatric disorders done if not by their symptoms?
No, I'm not talking about diagnosis. You're right about that. But I'm talking about the role symptoms play in defining disorders. In most areas of medicine, a disease isn't identified with the cluster of symptoms that may be used to diagnose it, but with the underlying cause of those symptoms. Suppose you come down with a fever, body aches, and start vomiting.
That sounds like I got some pretty terrible disease there, baby.
Yeah. But which disease? You could have the flu, or food poisoning, or heat stroke, or any of a number of other conditions that have those symptoms on occasion. We need to know the cause before a proper diagnosis can be made. So we do a blood test or urine test or something even more invasive to find out more. That's what makes medicine a science. It identifies underlying causes, not just symptoms.
Well, the fairness to psychiatry. The mind is pretty opaque, especially when it's not working properly, and it's a young science, and nobody has a clue, really, to what a lot of the underlying causes are. In the meantime, I mean, maybe defining disorders by clusters of symptoms the best we can do, and we kind of keep working to trying to figure out what the underlying causes really are.
Well, that's fine, but that's not actually what happens in psychiatry. Take the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Now, that's basically the Bible for psychiatrists here in the U.S. In the old days, it included homosexuality as a mental disorder.
Yeah, that was back in the old days. That was like in DSM. But they removed that in the 80s. You got to get with the times, John. The DSM is we're in the fifth edition of that thing.
Yeah, but even if it's in its latest incarnation, if you read it carefully and work through the definitions, you can see that they're including things like grief, the normal response to the death of a loved one, as a, quote, depressive disorder. It's sort of a joke.
No, you're not trying to say that there's no such thing as clinical depression, are you? Some people feel extremely sad all the time and for no apparent reason. It's got nothing to do with the circumstances of their life. It's not like they've lost anyone close to them or got fired or their marriage broke down. They just feel depressed all the time.
No apparent reason. Open your eyes. Look at the world. Read the news. Think about human life. Think about the size of the universe and the length of time. Melancholy is a normal response to the world for a rational, thoughtful person.
I don't want to get into that, John. Look, I'm going to grant you that the DSM has gotten some things wrong from time to time, and it's revised a lot on the basis of who knows what, but that doesn't mean it's not a scientific document. I mean, scientific progress happens when we throw out old theories that no longer work and replace them with newer, better theories. Maybe that's why the DSM is being revised theorize all the time. We're getting better and better at theorizing about things.
Nice try, big fella, but you got it wrong. I mean, it's not a theory-laden document at all. There's a methodology to science. One theory replaces another. We go from, you know, things to atoms to strings or God knows what else. When we replace old theories, it's because there's a lot of overwhelming evidence and the theories are testable. But that's not the way the DSM works. I mean, it's just, for one thing, a lot of cultural bias. I mean, being a homosexual, that's a disease. Being gay, oh, that's fine. The influence of insurance companies who won't pay out unless it's a disorder that you're suffering from. And the drug companies who can sell drugs for something if it is a disorder and get insurance companies to pay for them. It's a political document as much as a scientific document.
You know, but I don't. You can't throw out the baby with the bathwater. It doesn't mean there aren't any real psychiatric disorders and that we can never study psychiatry scientifically. I wouldn't buy that.
Well, I wouldn't try to sell it to you, but here's an interesting fact for you. Did you know that the symptoms of a mental disorder can be different depending on when and where you were born? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, to investigate the role culture plays in mental health. She files this report.
In the early 1990s in China, no one knew much about anorexia. And the few people who were diagnosed with the disorder had very different symptoms than American anorexics.
It tended to happen to older women, tended to happen to rural women. It did not have the fat phobia that's often associated with anorexia. It did not was not necessarily connected to dieting or wanting to lose weight.
That's Ethan Waters, author of Crazy Like Us, The Americanization of Mental Illness. He says unlike in America, Chinese anorexics had somatic complaints, a bloated stomach, a pain in the chest. But that all changed on November 24, 1994. That's when a teenage girl named Charlene died on a busy street in downtown Hong Kong. She was anorexic, and her very public death caught the attention of local media.
All these reporters that covered the story largely went to Western experts to find out, well, what is this thing called anorexia, and who does it affect, and what is it like? And suddenly, it was only after 1994 that you had this rise of the American version of anorexia.
The American version of anorexia defers to the DSM. To be anorexic, you must have, quote, an intense fear of gaining weight or becoming fat. Chinese media ran with that definition, and by the late 1990s, about 1 out of 10 women in China suffered from that form of anorexia.
Once these things become popularized, they get into the media, a celebrity displays the symptom, the symptomology acquires a certain gravity. You know, it just begins to pull people into its orbit more and more.
The U.S. is still very much in the anorexia orbit.
New rumors are surfacing about Mary-Kate Olsen's anorexia.
Both Hollywood Life and OK Magazine say that Lea Michele has developed an eating disorder.
Is Ariana Grande suffering from anorexia?
Back in the 19th century, female hysteria was a big problem in the U.S.
Hysteria, a uterine disease caused by sexual deprivation to which passionate women are particularly susceptible.
You have, you know, women by and large, by the tens of thousands, expressing this exceedingly clear disorder. Everyone knew what it was there. It was so common.
Prolonged abstinence from sexual stimulation, it was noted, could produce such symptoms as anxiety, loss of appetite, insomnia, fainting spells, erotic fantasies.
Today you're not going to see hysteria in the DSM because those symptoms no longer exist.
But that doesn't mean that the women that experienced those symptoms were in any way faking them or lying about them. Those were real symptoms. The doctor saw them, everyone saw them, they felt them, but they were only true in that time and place.
So what's the mental illness of the hour now?
Well, I think undoubtedly it's PTSD right now. It's so pervasive in our culture, this idea that trauma brings about mental illness in certain ways.
Waters says historically, soldiers have returned from war very troubled, but they all came back troubled in really different ways.
So if you had shell shock during the First World War, you came back with a series of largely somatic symptoms. So these were muscle tics or sensitivity to touch or fainting or grotesque body movements. In another time and place, if you were a Civil War veteran in the American Civil War, you had the feeling of a weak heartbeat or pathological homesickness.
Today's symptoms of PTSD are less somatic and more cerebral. Night terrors, flashbacks, and anxiety.
This idea that something can be real and shaped by culture is very hard for the American mind to understand because we think of ourselves as mentally independent from others, as not being shaped by culture.
Waters says until we can understand the role that culture plays in our society's mental health, we will never truly understand mental illness. Whether it's the onslaught of hysteria in the 19th century or the rise of PTSD today. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for reminding me of all the symptoms I've had over the years. I'm John Perry. With me is my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor.
And today, we're thinking about psychiatry and the mind. We're joined now by Jerome Wakefield. He's a professor at the NYU School of Social Work. He's co-author of two interesting books about psychiatry of the mind, The Loss of Sadness and All We Have to Fear. Jerry, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Great to be here.
So Jerry, the topic of psychiatry, I'm sure, is fascinating, and its conceptual foundations are very important. But in your particular case, how did you get interested in this?
Well, there were a couple of paths. I was studying philosophy at Berkeley and got interested in studying the philosophy of psychiatry. And I noticed when I started working on it that really there was a very minimal understanding of what a mental disorder really is. Of course, this took place with the backdrop of the attack, the anti-psychiatric attacks on psychiatry that were leading up to that time in the 50s, 60s, to some extent the 70s. And I was interested because I saw mental illness around me, even in my family, sometimes in myself. I wanted to solve this problem of how you explain what a mental illness or mental disorder is, and where I would both defend the legitimacy of psychiatry from the anti-psychiatrists who see it just as social control, and at the same time would give a grounds for critiquing its overuse. Drove me to this subject.
To Jerry, just to get us started, give us the basic result of your years of investigation. How do you define a mental disorder?
Well, you've got to start from, the two views that are prominent are that it's a value judgment. You're saying somebody has a condition that's really bad mentally. And another view is that it's purely a scientific judgment, that something's gone wrong with some internal mechanism that's psychological. The results of my own investigations is that neither of those definitions works, and that what you need is what I call a hybrid definition. A mental disorder is when you are experiencing some harm, something bad is happening. Yes, that's true. But it has to be harm that's due to what is called in psychiatry, and I use the same term, dysfunction. Something that's gone wrong in your mental mechanisms, in the way you generate your mental processes, that isn't the way those mechanisms were biologically or evolutionarily designed to work.
So look, Jerry, that's the only as those mechanisms were evolutionarily or biologically designed to work. Here's one of the problems that I perceive, I don't know if correctly, with mental health professionals, maybe less these days, but certainly when the DSM got going, they have so many different views of the mind, so many different, especially if you look at clinicians, you know, there's the Freudians, there's the cognitive, they have so many different views of the mind, and the DSM is supposed to serve them all. So isn't that a problem?
It's actually one of the problems. I mean, you know, I've been a critic of the DSM, but I also think that it was a valuable contribution in certain respects. It's one of the problems that the DSM is aimed at solving. You were talking earlier about the fact that they just use symptoms. Think of it this way. If you just define depression and anxiety disorders and so on in terms of symptoms, then everybody with their own theoretical views is on a level playing field. We all can buy the definition in terms of symptoms that somebody has those symptoms, something's going wrong. And therefore, the behaviorists, the psychoanalysts of five different flavors, the biological psychiatrists, and the family therapists, and so on, have a level playing field to try to explain those conditions and to try to show that their own approach works therapeutically the best with those conditions. So the symptom, if you think about it from kind of philosophy of science point, I mean, the symptom basis of the definitions in the DSM are providing a common language to resolve this theoretical Tower of Babel we had before the DSM in 1980,
yeah.
where each theory defined things in its own terms.
Well, that's an interesting thing, and I think it has big consequences, and we're going to have to dig into some of those consequences. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're thinking about psychiatry and the mind with Jerry Wakefield from the NYU School of Social Work.
If feeling depressed after the death of a loved one or the collapse of a marriage is now considered a mental disorder, then aren't we all mad? Or will be mad at some point in our lives? I mean, what's the line between normal grief and clinical depression?
Anxiety, depression, and psychiatry, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Such real things, and they change and change and change.
Is it really all right to cry? Maybe you should take something for that, Rosie, at least according to the DSM-5. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. We're thinking about disorders of the mind, the philosophy of psychiatry.
Our guest is Jerry Wakefield from NYU. He's the co-author of The Loss of Sadness and of All We Have to Fear.
So, Jerry, in reading one of your books, the one about sadness, so you talked about the DSM as a kind of, not quite political document, but a document that gives people with different theoretical outlooks a neutral language they can all share. But one of the consequences of that, it seems to me, and I think you believe this too, is that sometimes it defines disorders in a way that ought to whack with common sense. It defines depressive disorders so broadly to as include what most people would say is just ordinary grief. I mean, what's up with that?
You're absolutely right. The problem with every good idea has its downside, and the idea of defining things in terms of symptoms might have had some advantages. But once you start defining things in terms of symptoms, everything has symptoms. Normal grief is a group of symptoms that last a certain amount of time and can be defined. Illiteracy has symptoms in terms of failure in social role functioning and so on. So you basically have a situation where if you're not doing very careful conceptual analysis of what your disorders actually are meant to identify and what mental disorder is, then you're going to have definitions that explode on you. And this is what's happened with several of the disorders. I would say depression, confused with grief, confused with normal sadness, ADHD, confused with normal reactions to an overly constraining school environment, and so on. We have problems where the symptoms overshoot the mark, and there was not enough effort put in to prevent that, because conceptual analysis is difficult and it's not obvious how to construct counterexamples and so on. So the result, well, right now as we speak, of women in this country, in the United States, in their 40s and 50s, about a quarter of all of them are taking antidepressants. That's a mind-boggling amount. And We see pressure on young people to run to the doctor if they're not feeling cheerful, if they're feeling sad about something in their lives, that it's not expectable to feel sad for a while. So the problem with the symptom definition is it starts to constrain the range of normal human functioning and emotion that we want to respect,
Jerry,
I believe.
Jerry, I have you mentioned attention deficit hyperactive disorder, ADHD. Now, I have a question about that goes back to your hybrid definition. Your hybrid definition was harm and dysfunction, and in terms of function, you mentioned evolution. But now here's a scenario. I don't claim to be an evolutionary biologist, but I can imagine that, out there on the savannah, it was good to have at least some of the young boys and maybe girls, too, in the tribe that really had a lot of trouble paying attention to what was going on, so they could be paying attention to marauders and lions and tigers,
right,
and hyenas coming. So it could have been a very adaptive reaction to have at least some people in the population's genetic makeup made them have a lot of trouble not responding to new stimuli. So it was functional evolutionarily, but it is dysfunctional in school. So, I mean, is the function really the evolutionary function or the modern cultural function?
I would say that it has to be the evolutionary function in terms of judging normality. Now, you've hit the nail on the head. This is not a hypothetical. There really is research showing that a lot of the kids who have ADHD have a gene, DRD4 with 7 repeats, that is... Now, studies have gone out and looked at nomadic human populations and so on, and actually was apparently selected for the very reasons you're putting forward, that the gene encourages novelty-seeking, exploration, and so on. So if you were to then say, I think the alternative position you're outlining is, well, we don't care how something evolved. We don't care what was normal in terms of how we were shaped as human beings or biologically designed. What we care is whether somebody fits in with our current culture. It seems to me there are several objections against that, and one of them is it basically plays to the anti-psychiatric argument right away, which is that psychiatry is about social control. If we define things a certain way, we don't care how people are naturally built, you're going to have a disorder and be treated if you don't fit in.
Well, but so Jerry.
I think let me just say one thing about the ADHD. Most people who look at the ADHD problem and believe that we are constraining children beyond where they naturally were designed to be constrained, believe that it's not a disorder and go along with my intuitions on this. Sorry.
But so look, right. So, I mean, I think there's a really deep point here. I don't think it immediately gives rise to the anti-psychiatry point, but it does give rise to be careful not to overextend the psychiatric motto. Because look, in computer science and artificial intelligence, there are two ways a machine can be organized. It can be process driven, that is, it's trying to do something, and it looks for inputs from the environment sometimes, and only gets interrupted when it needs something from the environment. So it's process driven. It's trying to solve some problem. Or it can be what's called interrupt driven, where the environment gets to force itself on it constantly. Lots of processes are interrupt driven. Maybe some human minds are interrupt driven. In a culture that values process driven thought rather than interrupt driven thought, the interrupt driven guys are going to look out of place or something like that. But that's just, you should be cautious about saying that, you know, there's one privileged architecture of, you should be very, very, very cautious. You should not mix cultural preferences with the architecture of the mind. I don't think that automatically gets you to anti-psychiatry, but it does say, be very cautious. What do you think about that?
No, I agree. I don't think we're disagreeing on this, that be cautious. My caution is look at what we're actually designed to be. I mean, a good example is morning people and evening people. We know there really is a difference in circadian rhythm activity amongst people. Teenagers tend to be different than older people and so on and so forth. The sleep people don't pathologize that. They don't say that, even though it's crystal clear that a morning person is more adapted to our 9-to-5 culture than an afternoon or evening person, that therefore, if you're not a morning person, you have a disorder. Because, so far as we can tell, these are normal variations that were compatible with the way we were biologically designed. There's nothing going wrong with anything. It's just that our cultural values are clashing. Similarly, people find sexual interest in people other than their partners. That's not necessarily a disorder, although it may be very disruptive and problematic and need some direct intervention at times. And similarly, we have desires for fat and sugar, which in an environment that's has scarce supplies of those was a good idea. We were shaped to want those things because of the calories that helped us. But in our modern environment where we manufacture foods high in those, it's not very good. It's not a good thing that we have that taste. But nobody thinks it's a disorder to have that taste.
Yeah,
I think what I'm trying to say is that I don't think we're disagreeing. The caution comes in not pathologizing things which are not which are merely mismatches with our values and aren't really violations or dysfunctions in the way we're biologically designed.
Well, let me give you an analogy from out of the psychiatric field. I mean, when most women, at least most women in America, when they have children, take something for the pain, right? They get a shot or something.
Right.
But the pain is completely normal. I mean, you wouldn't expect to have an 8-pound thing come out of something that usually doesn't have that Anyway, you get the point. So is there anything really wrong with just giving people medicine, even though there isn't any underlying functional disorder, just because they don't like the normal processes? I mean, frankly, I was pretty skeptical about psychiatry in the opener, but psychiatry's played a positive role in my life, and it's given me some antidepressant that's really helpful. I don't really much care if it's because there's a dopamine gene that isn't working right, or it's just because I'm a melancholy creep.
Well, first of all, you're absolutely right, not about the creep part, but about the part that pain during childbirth, nobody really considers that a disorder, but we obviously medicate it for obvious reasons, relief of pain. For that matter, we give out contraceptives. There's nothing disordered about being fertile as a young woman, but there are reasons in our culture why patterning and controlling your reproductive life is crucial, and so we do that. So the answer to your question in brief is no, there's nothing intrinsically morally wrong or problematic with the idea of helping people who don't have disorders, even with medication, even occasionally with surgery, to deal with values and issues that they have. What's wrong, in my view, is for psychiatry to define vast domains of behavior as disorders. Because what happens is if normal behaviors are defined as disorders, that biases the discussion in informed consent between the patient and the physician about what should be done about it. If there's a disorder, you are inclined to do something medical about it, such as medication.
Yeah, and the fact that the drug companies are back there ready to profit off this makes it at least morally fraught. But we should let some callers in here. We got Stephen in Berkeley's on the line. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Stephen.
Oh, thank you very much. I've listened to your show before, and I think it's great, and it just stirs terrific debates. And this one, I mean, already I had a million thoughts here. I called because when you talked about veterans, I recall I knew a gentleman who passed away a few years ago who was in his 90s, and then my dad who lived through World War II, and they had very specific, distinct experiences that impacted them. And in a couple of cases, you know, ones that we would call, you know, creating post-traumatic stress syndrome. And then I've known Vietnam vets, and then I've also known a couple of guys who came back from the war in Iraq. And how they discussed the events that they went through was completely different. My real question is, so the World War II vets sort of talked about it as like something you sort of took and you put away, and you didn't bring it into your life. And the Vietnam vets talked about how it impacted them, and, you know, it was kind of more conflicting. And then current vets say, well, it's this, you know, post-traumatic stress syndrome. And my question is really, isn't it really about how we frame the items and discuss them that really either gives power to them or not, or allows us to live with them and own them?
Good question, Stephen. So what do you think, Jerry?
It's absolutely right. One of the issues with mental disorder is that you have a complicated meaning system with all sorts of meanings, cultural meanings, individual meanings, other meanings that are interacting with whatever's going on with these issues. And you will have, as was discussed earlier in the show, you will have dramatic variations in how various issues emerge depending on culture and time. I do think PTSD, to some degree in its modern form, has been defined the way it is. And the caller is right that one could argue that there's a real value to exploring the meanings rather than seeing it as, let's say, a brain disorder that should be immediately targeted by medication. Because after all, one of the problems with PTSD is the inability to integrate this violation of your basic values and your basic view of life into your overall meaning system and just see it as part of you, as part of something that happened, is negative perhaps, but something that happened that can be understood. So processing using meaning, and psychotherapy, for instance, focuses on this, is an essential adjunct, in my view, to dealing with conditions like this using medication or more traditional medical means.
So as philosophers, we're kind of intrigued by the self image of psychiatry and whether it's a science or not. But we don't want to miss the point that psychiatry works for a lot of people. And we got email from Steve who says, "The truth, psychiatry has worked for me. I have a severe brain injury and I am on disability. I take a lot of medicines, yes, but they are for problems that I have. But at least I am going somewhere in life. It might be sad, but my best friend is my psychiatrist." Thanks, Steve.
Well, you know, I wanted to add something to what you were saying, Derek, and this kind of relates to the email. But I think it's really striking that mental disorders, I mean, there often probably is some brain dysfunction there of some kind, something's gone on in the brain, confusion in the secret place, as a poet once said. But the brain is a meaning-making thing. So whenever it finds itself in a trauma, it's doing some interpreting. So now the question is, I don't know what to think of as the disorder. Is the malinterpretation, the brain disorder, the combination? And can you treat the interpretive thing without, you know, the inability to integrate this event into your life without the drugs? If you do the drugs, does that take care of it? I mean, how to think about all that stuff? Help me, Jerry.
I think I wish I had a nice, succinct answer. Well, I will give you a succinct answer. But first, let me just say about the email that absolutely, as in all things in life, the fact that you criticize an institution, maybe its overshoot or maybe some problems with it, does not mean that you are casting it aside, throwing out the baby with the bathwater and saying it's all bad. In fact, I wouldn't be spending my time on philosophy of psychiatry if I didn't think that there was a lot of good in it and that there was a lot of productive intervention in people's lives that I see all around me. And I was a therapist for some years, and I tried to do my bit as well. So I think the email has to be acknowledged as, you know, a very important point that in looking at these various issues, the fact that there are problems doesn't mean that this isn't a valuable institution that's just having growing pains conceptually. Sorry, the question, I lost the question.
Meaning, you know, the inability to integrate, that's a cognitive meaning thing. And then the drugs, how do they work together?
Right. Okay. So look, I mean, first of all, at a kind of philosophical conceptual level, a standard point is that think of this like the software-hardware distinction, right? I mean, it is possible that every mental disorder has some biological brain disorder associated with it. That's the standard ideology right now. 40 years ago, it wasn't the standard ideology. Now it is. Do we know what these brain disorders are? No, but it's the standard ideology. Must the ideology be true? Must it be true that every mental disorder is a brain disorder, that something's gone wrong at the physiological level? Personally, I don't think so, and I think the software-hardware analogy just illustrates the conceptual point. You would be foolish to think that every software problem was a hardware problem just because software runs in hardware. Sometimes it's the software that's the problem, the way that that representational system, the algorithms, were designed or are interacting with the inputs. It's nothing. You could look forever in the silicon chips in your computer, and you'd never find a problem. You just find it operating routinely.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about psychiatry and the mind with Jerry Wakefield from the NYU School of Social Work.
What's the best way to help those who suffer psychologically? Should we label them with a mental disorder and treat them accordingly? Or is there a better approach?
Curing life's troubles and the mind's ills when Philosophy Talk continues.
Madness, defined in our culture by the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual for Mental Disorders. We're thinking about the philosophy of psychiatry. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is Jerry Wakefield, co-author of some interesting books about psychiatry, The Loss of Sadness and All We Have to Fear. And each of them have very long subtitles, but I don't have time to read them.
Okay, Jerry, in a minute, I'm going to make you editor-in-chief of the next edition of DSM. But first, I'm going to make a suggestion, right? I mean, think about cars. Computers are too hard for me to think about. Think about cars. Now, one thing you can have with a car is a repair manual. But what most people need with a car is something more general. It says, if you're dissatisfied with your car, there's many levels that might explain that. For example, I used to have a 1930 Model A. I don't think that would work very well in the present world. Not because there's any, was anything wrong with it, but because it just doesn't fit into the culture where, where you're supposed to go 70 miles an hour, which it couldn't do without shaking. Another situation might be, you know, you had to deal differently in the winter than the summer. You had to retard the spark differently and maybe set the thing. And then finally, there might be something wrong inside of it. So shouldn't the DSM, under your editorship, which I'm going to bestow on you in just a second, be more like a manual for all the different ways people might be dissatisfied with their life, including, so to speak, mechanical problems with the brain, rather than an attempt to turn psychiatry into just mechanics? So how you get, so well, now you are editor of the DSM. You can do anything you want with it. You can scrap it. You can follow my advice. You can make whatever changes you want. What are you going to do?
Well, first to address the question they just raised, you know, the DSM has a long list, very long list of what are called in the business V codes or Z codes, which are codes for conditions that are not disorders. But are the sorts of things that people come in to see mental health professionals about, such as sibling rivalry, family issues, marital conflict, occupational problems, so on and so forth, endless. So so the first thing one would say about what DSM needs to do is, yes, I totally agree. It needs to expand the range and the precision of these descriptions to cover all the sorts of things that human beings suffer from in our culture and come to us for help for. But keep in mind, the insurance reimbursement system in our culture reimburses, generally speaking, leaving aside contraception, a few other exceptions, generally speaking, is limited to medical disorders that are mental disorders. So the idea that it's a disorder, the concept we've been discussing today, becomes crucial to the whole system, to having it as part of the health professions. So I wouldn't abandon that distinction. I would, number one, look at each set of criteria for each disorder, depression, ADHD, PTSD, and do a very careful conceptual analysis, which was rejected as an idea for DSM-5, by the way, it was proposed and rejected. Do a very careful conceptual analysis of how to distinguish that disorder from normal conditions that might look similar but are variations in how people interact with our culture. I would involve context much more, because the truth is you can't tell really what's going on inside a human being unless you look at the context in which it's occurring, both the immediate context and the cultural context. And I would offer clinicians more flexibility, because the reality is we don't know very much about the mind and the brain, how it works. Clinicians have to have more flexibility in these algorithms for bringing in additional evidence and making an overall judgment about whether something's really gone wrong or whether this is something that can be dealt with as a part of life and life's various challenges and suffering.
Jerry,
those are some of the changes.
Jerry, you're making me kind of... My skepticism, I know you don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater, but my skepticism about this whole enterprise has increased, not decreased. Because look, I mean, it's like we're pretending to have a unified science here when we don't have a unified science. We have a Tower of Babel, right? And we have an insurance regime that says, well, you got to give me some disorders or I'm not going to reimburse you. And we've got drug companies that say, well, I got a whole bunch of stuff here, man. I want to be able to prescribe. I want you to be able to prescribe this. I want to be able to advertise this. It seems to me like a huge social, political, and just pharmaceutical complex thing operating here. And the people, we're just mystified by this, right? I mean, they tell you your kid has ADHD and should be drugged and this, that, and the other thing.
Yeah, but it sounds like if we made Jerry czar, one thing he would have to do is hire some philosophers to help, because he wants to do some conceptual analysis. And that's a great idea, because we got a lot of philosophers that need jobs and could really do a good job with this sort of thing.
Look, you don't have to be a it's true. I think philosophers could be very helpful, but you don't have to be a philosopher. Look, on TV shows, The Sopranos, they had a show where the guidance counselor at the school wanted to diagnose their child as having ADHD, and they, in their response, gave what every, you know, sensible person could recognize as a devastating critique of the silliness of using the symptoms in his case without any context. So I think we're dealing here with something which, if you did it my way, there would be a dramatic increase in the validity of these categories. And that's what's the problem. I mean, the problem right now is that the focus has been on giving clinicians labels that are reimbursable, which is laudable because you're helping people. But you're confusing disorder with normality and normal suffering. And as a result, you're undermining the entire seed for research for the future of our field. I mean, where we are now, I mean, yes, it was mentioned earlier that physical medicine looks at causes. Where we are now in psychiatry, maybe this is a little overly extreme, but compare it more to Hippocrates than to Pasteur. I mean, we're at a place where we don't know how the internal mechanisms work, and from context, we're doing the best we can to judge what is a disorder. These criteria are not doing that very well, but the enterprise shouldn't be abandoned, because to ever have a science of psychiatry that really will be able to identify when things go wrong, we have to try the best we can, just as Hippocrates did, to identify conditions and classify them. And then by our bootstraps, we will over time perhaps have a better science, which can really help people better than we can today.
Jerry, we've got an email right on this point from Lucy in San Francisco. Can you ask the guests what the difference between a psychiatric disorder and a medical disorder is? When the underlying causes of a psychiatric disorder are discovered, does it become a medical disorder? And I'll just add to that, in one of the earlier editions of the DSM, didn't they kind of essentially say that to be a psychiatric disorder, you had to not have a physical cause identified? Or is that my imagination?
Well, it's maybe it's not quite imagination, but elaboration on truth. The DSM only classifies things as psychiatric disorders. Most of the classifications are for things that don't have an obvious general medical condition, like if you have a thyroid problem that's causing you to be depressed, that would be eliminated. But that's not the main issue here. The main issue here is, once we discover that there's a brain physiological source of it, does it go out of the mental disorders category altogether? This could happen, for instance, with Alzheimer's disease pretty soon, which is currently in the manual. And the answer is that this is a confusing area. To make something physical versus mental disorder is a confusing area, and nobody has a very good handle on it right now. However, the idea that if it's physical, it's not a mental disorder, that's too extreme, because whenever a mental mechanism, a psychological mechanism goes wrong, you do have some kind of psychiatric malfunction. If your sadness-generating mechanisms, whatever they are, we don't understand them yet, are generating these signals of sadness, even though nothing's happening, there's been no loss, there's been no stress. If you're having panic attacks for absolutely no reason, so that your anxiety is not associated in any way with imminent threat or danger, we presume something's gone wrong, and those are psychiatric disorders.
Chris in San Francisco, be brief, please. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. What Jerry is saying about context is just, that would be my takeaway for people who have listened to this hour. I would like to know what people who have been listening to this program, because you have touched on so many issues of such profound significance, what are we supposed to take away from this as far as how we think and work differently with people who are experiencing problems in living?
Very good question, Chris. So, Jerry, can you give us a parting shot on that question here? What's the takeaway?
The takeaway should be that basically current criteria sometimes overshoot the mark, And we should be always thinking about a stepped approach to mental disorder or suffering, where you start by looking at the context and try to discern, is this normal suffering that can be dealt with in some other way first, or you can try some less intrusive, less medicational approach, or is it something that clearly has gone wrong and that needs a different kind of approach? The main takeaway is that you have to keep these options in mind, that not that labeling everything as a mental disorder is misleading and potentially harmful if you immediately leap to over-intervening. But on the other hand, I have to emphasize this. There really are, this point that I made against antipsychiatry, there really are mental disorders. They really are sometimes horrific, and people do need intervention. And so there's nothing here that suggests that you should resist treatment where the evidence is that something is going wrong and that medication or some other intervention can help.
Jerry, on that note, I'm going to have to thank you for joining us. We're all the time. It's been a great conversation. We have touched on lots of things. I'd love to have you back sometime.
Okay. Thanks a lot. Great. Enjoy it.
Our guest has been Jerry Wakefield. He's a professor at the NYU School of Social Work, co-author of two very fine books on psychiatry, All We Have to Fear and The Loss of Sadness, How Psychiatry Transformed Normal Sorrow into Depressive Disorder. So, John, you got a brief, very brief thought for me?
Well, psychiatry is a field where the problems comes first and their theory comes later. A lot of science is the other way around, like, you know, the things the Hubble telescope is telling us about far-off galaxies, we don't know what we're going to do with that information. So it's got problems that other scientists don't have, and we need to be understanding.
Yeah, and there's lots of money at stake, insurance money and drug company money. That's the thing that we really need to talk about, the entanglement of this thing. But, you know, this conversation continues at Philosopher's Corner at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo, I think, therefore I blog. And you, too, can become a partner in that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now let's hear from the possibly disordered mind of a doubtlessly fast-talking philosopher. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, when my neighbors peer through my windows, as I'm sure they do, they must wonder why I walk around in a bathrobe all day. It's not because I'm clinically depressed. It's because I'm self-employed. I could get dressed and shave, but what's the point? I work at home alone. Am I trying to impress myself, with my low self-esteem? Not worth the trouble. The trouble is, of course, my neighbors and or loved ones, if they could find any, could stage an intervention. Or even come to the door and suggest to me I seek professional help. Doubt it. For a diagnosis to occur, I'd have to get dressed and leave the house. This makes any actual diagnosis of whatever mental problems I may or may not have problematic. And if I want insurance to cover whatever it is I may or may not have, I can't just be all, you know, oh, I'm in a brown study today, doctor. I'm in a blue funk. I feel like Tammy gazing out the window on a rainy autumn day, like Eric Clapton waiting for Patty Boyd to notice he's alive. Doc, I'm like Al Gore after a Florida recount, like Mitt Romney trying to grow a soul patch, like Ted Cruz watching President Obama disregard the Constitution, or Netanyahu forced to go on vacation in Iran. I'm like Pete Seeger when Dylan went electric, or Dylan trying to blow in the wind on a sunny, still day. I'm an old Labrador waiting at the door, Grandpa when the turkey's gone. It's not a clinical condition, is my point. It's not covered. Can I just stay here at home, unshaven, needing a shower to work on my epic rock and roll novel, 300 pages and counting, and, of course, going on Facebook. Okay, pretty much going on Facebook all the time. If we don't go on Facebook, we get sad. Plus, there's the hope that somebody will post what's wrong with us on Facebook. That's what the internet is for. So we can self-diagnose. We can self-medicate with wine, marijuana, meth, crack, or heroin. You can even self-medicate with television or the internet. You can become addicted to Facebook. It's true. I read a post about it on Facebook. And I just read in an op-ed in the New York Times that Abilify is now the number one seller among all drugs in the United States. Now, Abilify is an antipsychotic you're supposed to take for schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. I guess you can take it if you're feeling a little down. Kind of like using dynamite on a toothache. But sure, you can take it for a reverie gone horribly wrong if you call your reverie disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Insurance covers that. Or you can just get drunk at home. Make sure you close the curtains, though. The neighbors are way into neighbor shaming, and it could trigger a psychotic break, which would mean, of course, you'd have to shave and get dressed. Who wants that? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW, local public radio, San Francisco, and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2017.
Our executive producers are David Demarest and Matt Martin.
Our senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler, Angela Johnston, and Colin Peden.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed or misexpressed in this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you, too, can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Gleeman X makes it feel like it's 72 degrees in your head. Oh.